Hello again, everyone. Part 5. Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. Well, let's see how far we can get through it now. We're getting close to the end. There's a major shift going on in the Diamond Sutra right now. This conversation that Shakyamuni created as a sermon is a conversation between the Buddha mind and Shibuti, who up until this sutra believed that he had reached the pinnacle of Buddhist practice. He is a Hinayanist, and like Theravada, like many branches of Hinayana Buddhism today, and even some Mahayana sects that still adhere to Hinayana thinking. And that will just become clearer with more and more study. But this sutra is dedicated to that very problem. Shibuti and the Hinayanists believe that the early teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha were the only teachings of merit. So when the teachings go on through the next 100 years or so to expound on the Buddha's meaning, the meanings of Shakyamuni's sermons, and a lot of our, Buddhism has a long history of scholarly debate, not just debate amongst practitioners, but practitioners with tremendous history and insight into all of the practices, who practice for a very long time. In fact, if you read and learn much about Nichiren, the 13th century scholar, the debates that they would have amongst other sects were incredibly refined and specific. And just by following from the get-go Shakyamuni's words, a lot of aberrations were very easily debunked, because it's actually a very straightforward practice. But there's always, we are humans, and there are always those who want to say, I know best, and mine is better. And, this kind of thing is very human behavior. And sometimes it's coerced, because throughout the ages, over thousands of years now, a lot of religious, or I shouldn't say religious, because maybe early Buddhism could be looked at as a sort of a religion, but Buddhism was never about religious, what is typically belief systems, and so-called, because they require you to suspend your logical mind and just take some mystical or magical statement with no basis in reality as experienced to be a truth. That's what religion is. Buddhism has never proposed to be that. Buddhism, from before Shakyamuni was enlightened, was always about, how do I take a life and make it less miserable? How do I release those things that cause so much suffering in life? Admittedly, he came from Shangri-La, he was a prince, and he wasn't allowed to see the suffering outside the kingdom. But when he, at a young age, got himself out there and looked around and saw a lot of sickness, a lot of misery, a lot of death, old age, and things he'd never experienced or seen before. So this is how he entered into his specific path to find a way that people shouldn't have to feel this way or experience these negative things, because life, especially as he experienced it, should be just beautiful. Just, you wake up in awe every day at how amazing and precious all life is manifest. So again, so Hinayana doesn't get the full breadth of that because as demonstrated so far in our talks, Shibhuti comes to a point where he finally gets it that denial of the self or this pursuit of selflessness, no self, though it may be quite an advancement, and it was meant to be. It was a part of the process of opening your mind up to understanding the more later teachings still, until finally, in the last few years of his life, Shakyamuni taught the Lotus Sutra, and after that, as he was preparing for Nirvana, the Parinirvana, Mahaparinirvana Sutra, and basically it validated, if you don't need me around to teach you anymore, you've got the Lotus Sutra, and now you can take over. That just getting rid of your self attachments was actually a very selfish act, because you had, although you'd achieved some awakening, obviously, as an arhat, or what is also called the sravakas, people of learning and realization, there's a tremendous aha to that and a tremendous relief, but it's very selfish. It's only about you. So you really haven't gotten it, because from the get-go, this method is supposed to release everyone without caste, culture, intelligence, economics, doesn't matter. Because, as Shakyamuni said, if a truth is really a truth, then it applies to everyone, everything, all the time. It's not just certain people. Now, having said that, there are allowances he makes that for some people in certain eras, reaching arhat can bring you to a state of enlightenment. But as time goes on and capacity goes on, that's no longer practicable. And it's not efficient because it's only for a few. So this is the whole basis of Bodhisattva practice, what the Lotus Sutra really nails down. And we're going to get to that. And I don't know how many videos it will take to study that, but I'm going to study it with you. I've got a dozen sources for the Lotus Sutra. So we're going to look at Chinese, Indian, Japanese, blah, blah, blah. We're going to look at commentary about it. I really want to nail it down because that is the ultimate teaching of Buddhahood. All right. So before I have to declare yet another video, let's get into this. All I wanted to do was set it up that Subhuti came to tears when he finally realized that what he'd spent his life doing was what had value, but ultimately fell short of the mark. And now he's asking questions and he wants to know more. And the Buddha Shakyamuni is playing his game again about, okay, you think you know this now, but what does it mean if I do this? Oh, well, no, I guess you wouldn't, you wouldn't, because there wouldn't be. And something that's becoming clear right now, and this next chapter is going to start to deal with it, is this double track of the mind. There's the mind that we experience from our karma as human beings in this condition of samsara. This condition of samsara is a condition of differentiation. But the true nature of everything, all phenomena, has not only no self, and this is where it gets confusing. You think that by learning how you can accept no self, that you've escaped self, but the negation of something is only a validation that it exists or existed. You know? If you wash your clothes, it's not because the dirt never existed. That's why you washed your clothes. So if you wash your clothes, you're absolutely saying there was dirt. Do you see? So a bodhisattva's perception goes beyond this, and it's actually harder to perceive that there's no self if it's harder to perceive that the self never existed in the first place. And I'm sure if you think about that for a moment, yeah, that's totally different than saying I can get rid of myself, my attachment to a self, but you're still attached to the idea of a self. And the truth is, there never was a self. Ooh, that's a little harder. All right. So here we go. Chapter 22. The Buddha now skips his intervening lifetimes and proceeds to Bodh Gaya, where he reached the end of the Bodhisattva path and realized enlightenment. While others might proclaim the wonders of such, excuse me, I'm not a good page turner anymore, the wonders of such a world-shaking experience, truly, the Buddha denies that he obtained or found anything at all. Now see, that's why I wanted to preface this. Because we think we're learning something. But what we're really doing in Buddhist practice is unlearning. Because all our learning is based on perception. And what's perception based on? Me and other, self. So when you finally get to enlightenment, what you've actually done is cast aside, put away, transcended, perfect word, everything that you thought. Period. Is it, that's why we talk about ending thought. It's not that you can stop your brain from working. The thoughts are there because you're in samsara. Once you can perceive from your Buddha mind, which transcends your brain mind, your human mind, all of what you've perceived is now perceived as never having been perceived. It sounds like a play on words, but you can understand that you work yourself to a frenzy, fighting a wind to get inside of a building. And you finally make it inside the building, torn and tattered, and you look out the window and there's no wind at all. So everything you thought about the wind, experienced about the wind, was just in your mind. And when your mind is cleared of all of those unnecessary perceptions that are just created by karma, that energy that manifested you, karma, and continues to exist in this condition of samsara and gives you this sense that you are experiencing it. In fact, when you turn around and look through the window, there's no you. And all of that was just of the mind. Okay. The teacher teaches no teaching. Because he learned nothing. And he learned nothing because the teaching contains no teaching. What the Buddha learned was like the jewel he pla him himself placed in the ragged cloth clothing of a poor traveler in the Nirvana Sutra. Enlightenment turns out to be something the Buddha was never without. So how could he obtain it? Then too, the hand cannot grasp itself, nor can the mind know itself. Chao Ming titles this No Dharma to Realize. Hui Ning says, unexcelled perfect enlightenment does not actually include the slightest dharma, but the dharma that contains nothing is everywhere around us. Thus follows a chapter on not realizing any dharma. Regarding unexcelled perfect enlightenment, you hear that phrase all samyak sambodhi. How's that? Samyak. I forgot. Anyway, regarding unexcelled perfect enlightenment, that's how it translates. Hardayal, the English scholar, says, quote, the simple root perception, shorn of all accretions and amplifications, is omniscience. It has been described as incomprehensible for the ratiocinative intellect. It is infinite because the qualities that produce it are infinite. It is pure and perfect knowledge of all things, free from uncertainty and obscurity. There's a million ways to say this, and I'm trying to simplify it so you get it, a filter to put all of this through so it keeps validating itself, because that's what we're doing here. The Buddha said, so it is, Subhuti, so it is. The slightest dharma is neither obtained nor found therein. Thus is it called unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Now that's the kind of statement you hear a lot throughout this sutra and many others. It took me a while to figure out that this refers to, in my mind, back to a quote from Laurie Anderson, a well-known artist, musician. And she was talking about Buddhism a little bit one day, and she said that whatever she's doing was like Buddhism, in that there's the thing, and then there's the name for the thing, and that's really one thing too much. It's very simply put, and very wise of her to grasp that. But this is the mechanism that Shakyamuni uses. There is not this, there has never been this. That's why it's called this. Because in our normal samsaric perception of things, because everything relates to our individuality, our me-ness, our I-ness, everything's either a possession, an obstacle, a hindrance, or an aid. Everything references the me. Okay? So, when we want to look at a concept that doesn't represent any of that, we're still behooved to give it a label so that we can identify it as not being any of that. We still refer to our body. Okay? Dharmas are the building blocks of reality, and some early Buddhist sects identified more than 100. These included the senses, the sensations, the mind and its various psychological functions, the states, nirvana, and space. However, in his use of the adjective anus, slightest, from the root anu, atom, the Buddha does not have in mind any of these later analytical entities, but simply anything held to be real. A speck of reality, if you will. When the Buddha realized the Dharma body of unexcelled perfect enlightenment, he not only did not find the greatest of dharmas, he did not find the slightest, most insignificant of dharmas. He did not find even an atom of reality, which is the Buddha's Dharma body. The awareness of this is what the Buddha means by unexcelled perfect enlightenment. He's pointing. Unexcelled perfect enlightenment is a finger pointing. What it's pointing at is birthlessness, arisinglessness, that everything we perceive is an experience in our mind. And it is that way because we are in a condition that our karma manifests in this way, so we can experience our karma. But if you understand that karma was just the energy in the first place, and whatever dream it's going through, this function of samsara to exist, is just that, a temporary blip in the expanse of everything that isn't anything, because nothing is truly made, then we're right back to quiescent energy, that all of this has just been a a drama played out in our minds. In his commentary, Nan Hui Qin likens So It Is, Subhuti, So It Is, to an enigma that doesn't make sense until we solve it ourselves. And he cites the story about Qin Hua Chu Ti. Master Qin Hua Chu Ti learned one finger Zen from Hang Chu Ting Ung, and this is all he taught. Whenever anyone asked for instruction, he held up one finger and nothing more. One day when he was absent, a young voice tried this on a layman who had come for instruction. When the worshiper was enlightened, the novice couldn't wait to tell the master. But when Chui Ti heard what happened, he went into the kitchen and came out and asked the novice to show him again. When the novice stuck out his finger, Chu Ti whipped out a knife and cut it off. As the novice ran screaming out the door, Chu Ti yelled his name. When the novice stopped, Chu Ti asked him the meaning of enlightenment. Without thinking, the novice stuck out his fist. But when he saw his hand without the finger, he suddenly understood the meaning of one finger's end. A Sangha says, because no Dharma dwells therein, Bodhi is called unexcelled. Bodhi. Because the Dharma realm doesn't grow, its nature is pure and equal. Vasubandhu comments, only if there is no Dharma can be realized can it be called unexcelled perfect enlightenment. If there's nothing beyond it, it is nothing. The last two lines of this refer to what is said in the next chapter. Dharmagupta's translation gives Tsen Qin, grow or shrink. Well, I'll read this too. Tsen Chao says, the Buddha is a person. We know he isn't. Enlightenment is the way. Because the Buddha realized the way, he explained it to people. But if the Buddha says there's no Dharma to explain, did he realize the way? Enlightenment means an end to form and the omniscience of emptiness. Since enlightenment has no form, what is there to realize? Complete extinction, is in which nothing is realized, is the ultimate way. Well, that's obviously the words of a Zen Buddhist, because they're hung up on emptiness, just like Hinayana Buddhists are hung up on no self. All right, let's move on. Chapter 23. We went through a chapter already. 23. Furthermore, Subhuti, undifferentiated is this Dharma in which nothing is differentiated. Thus is it called unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Without a self, without a being, without a life, without a soul, undifferentiated is this unexcelled perfect enlightenment by means of which all auspicious dharmas are realized. And how so? Auspicious dharmas, Subhuti, auspicious dharmas are spoken of by the Tathagata as no dharmas. Thus are they called auspicious dharmas. So he's done it again. We have a label for what happens when you get rid of all your misperceptions. You get to the place where there's no perception. If there's no perception, there's nothing there. There's just energy, potential. Potential for what? Potential for energy to manifest something and create a samsaric condition again. But it doesn't have to. It's just a condition. Your new shoes never have to get wet, but you may get caught in the rain. You may step in a puddle. You may just like to run around in wet grass. They will get wet. But that's not the natural condition of the shoe. And of course, as bad as an analogy that is, at this point in the book, this sutra, I need to say that the shoe never existed in the first place. How much harder is it to get it wet then? It's irrelevant, right? That's what he's talking about. Only pursuing the bodhisattva path of interacting with others to learn more deeply your own self as well as the self of others, and then having to move that through the path of the self never existed, that this is all a play in the mind, and enlightenment is a release from all of the turmoil and pain that's implied, implicit, or explicitly in the manifestation of that karma. Another way of looking at it is, enlightenment is realizing that karma never existed in the first place. In the previous chapter, the Buddha says the Dharma that cannot be realized is what he meant or means by unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Here he explains that unexcelled perfect enlightenment cannot be realized because it possesses no features, no qualities, no aspects, nothing that can be differentiated. And I came to that word in my studies several years back. And I'm happy to see it in the scholarship of these sermons and writings. Just ponder, if you will, no differentiation next time you sit and meditate or chant. It's almost unfathomable. You can say it, you can understand the English of it, but to actually understand the reality of no differentiation, that comes close to the actual practice of a bodhisattva. Nor is there within it something greater, no greater self, no greater leveler, no greater being, no greater life, no greater soul. It is instead the greater leveler, and yet it is precisely because it contains nothing that can be differentiated that it is the source of all auspicious dharmas. Which are those dharmas used in the work of liberation, and which are the focus of the second half of this sutra? And yet, they are only auspicious because they contain nothing. There are no dharmas. The Buddha also calls such dharmas Buddha dharmas. Why do you imagine he calls them Buddha dharmas? Because Buddha is your mind. And your mind, once it perceives that there's nothing to perceive, has no dharma. So there's a positing in this sutra that once you reach Buddhahood, the Buddha mind, there is no Buddha mind. Because that too is a convention of our selfness. Right? Because we got to differentiate it. I'm trying to do something where I can get to be something I'm not. That's an attachment to you. You see what this is, what this sutra is all about. We are very clever with our samsaric identities and mind to identify everything as an entity. But so how do you get past being an entity without using the words that are part and parcel of your being trapped in this samsaric reality? Try to write about it. And Shakyamuni says it all the time, that the reality of Buddhahood cannot be captured with words. But I have to tell you about it and give you a way to get there. So here we go. Okay? Furthermore, Subhuti, undifferentiated is this dharma in which nothing is differentiated. Thus, is it called unexcelled perfect enlightenment? We just talked about that. In the previous chapter, the Buddha says he did not find even an anu, atom, in the Dharma of enlightenment. Here he tells us that the reason he found nothing was because such a Dharma contains nothing. In describing what is imperceptible and ungraspable, the Buddha uses the Sanskrit sama, undifferentiated. Normally, sama means even or level, as in level ground. Here, however, it refers to the absence of anything that can be separated from or distinguished in the Dharma body of enlightenment. With a self, without a being, without a self, without a being, without a life, without a soul, undifferentiated is this unexcelled. I hope this is starting to make sense. But to me, this is the crux. That's why I'm not reading every word. This is the crux of this entire sutra. I still encourage you to read the whole thing. I'm just interjecting to try to give you some contemporary language to wrap your mind around this. Perfect enlightenment means by means of which all auspicious dharmas are realized. But what's realized? That there are no auspicious dharmas. That's auspicious. Constantly talks in this back and forth manner. It's fairly effective if you really start to understand what he's doing in this. The absence of the four perceptions of self, a being, a life, and a soul is what the Buddha means by undifferentiated. If any of these attributes are present, a dharma is differentiated and is not undifferentiated. Undifferentiated means devoid of attributes. The only attribute of which an undifferentiated dharma is no attribute. But because of its absence of attributes, it is the source of all auspicious dharmas, by means of which all beings are able to enter the sanctuary of enlightenment. Thus, in chapter 5, the Buddha tells Subhuti that Tathagata can indeed be seen, but only by means of attributes that are no attributes. Remember my cornfield analogy? Now imagine you come out of the cornfield, and the Jeep is just in space. There's no ground. There's not only is all the stalks of corn and gone, and all the noise of it, and so forth, but you're now floating. But you're no longer you either, because you were never there. The Jeep was never there. The cornfield was never there. And so now you know what full detachment from delusion might look like if you were to write a children's book about it or a movie. The contradiction being that the only reason you'd write a book or a movie is if you're in samsara, right? Okay. Moving on. Like I said, I'm jumping over a lot of stuff here. I just want to hit the meat, and hopefully it encourages you to question more and read more, study, study, study. Okay, I'm studying with you right now, and really want you to fill in the blanks that I didn't. Chapter 24, moreover, Subhuti, if a man or woman brought together as many piles of the seven jewels as all the Mount Sumerus in the billion worlds of the universe, and gave them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhans, the fully enlightened ones, and a noble son or daughter grasped but a single four-line gatha of this Dharma teaching, of the perception of a perfection of wisdom, and made it known to others, Subhuti, their body of merit would be greater by more than 100-fold, indeed, by an amount beyond comparison. So once again, he's going back to driving forth the idea of material, no matter how much you amass and how much you value it, whatever merit you think you've achieved with it, is really no merit at all compared to the wisdom you gain from just a little bit of this teaching. The impression given is that, sorry, I got a wild hair there, sorry. That even if all you know is a four-line gatha, one thing, one little stanza, if you will, that will propel you to learn more around it. But I don't want to put words into this, but that's the implication, that even if all you know is a little bit, the merit, the wisdom that you gain, the worldview that you gain, the way that you'll speak to others will be an immense, immense change toward your enlightenment, which is far greater reward and merit than all the jewels and precious things you could give to someone. After telling his disciples the bodies are no bodies and dharma are no dharmas, the Buddha is concerned that those who don't understand the differences among the five eyes might now choose to ignore the cultivation of a body of merit and the cultivation and dissemination of this teaching. Hence, he once again reminds Subhuti of the merit that results from understanding and making the mother of Buddhas known to others. What could be more auspicious and yet at the same time transcend the limits of auspiciousness? Again, the emphasis is on skill in means in realizing the realization that is no realization and in teaching the teaching that is no teaching. So I guess another way to say that is, if you don't have much money and you can't amass all this wealth or jewels or whatever it is to give to others to achieve some status or merit in your life, stop worrying about your position and your possessions. Teach this a little tiny bit at a time. Just pick a favorite one and tell it to as many people as you encounter. The fortune that you will grow in your life will be hundredfold whatever you might be able to amass and offer as material to somebody. I'll tell you myself, I've kind of had a dual, I don't know, I can't really call it dual, but it seems that way sometimes. You know, I've been a Buddhist monk for 30 years. I still study and study and study. I learn something new every time I reread a sutra or find another scholarship about it. But I've also been an artist as a way to try to, you know, we live in a predatory capitalist world. So we need money. And as a Buddhist in America, especially in the Bible Belt, I have very limited means of getting donations for teaching Buddhism. It doesn't stop me from doing it. I do it. The more issues I have with money, the more I work on videos like this and teaching people and so forth. I'm following these words as best I can. And lately, I've been considering just stopping painting altogether, because I've been for the last couple of years seeing painting as a device that attaches me to things, and I'm trying to profit from people's attachment to things by selling the things that I make to be things for them. And I think I just have to stop doing that and just focus solely on Buddhism. So that's an aside I just thought I'd share. Moreover, Subhuti, if a man or woman brought together as many piles of the seven jewels as all Mount Sumerians in the billion worlds of the universe and give them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhans and the Full Enlightened Ones. This is the sixth such comparison The first contrasted this teaching with an offering of enough jewels to fill the billion worlds of a single universe. The second was an offering of enough jewels to fill countless universes. The third was an offering of as many lives as there are grains of sand in the Ganges. The fourth was an offering of as many lives as there are grains of sand in the Ganges every day for endless kalpas. And the fifth contrasted this teaching with the merit from venerating countless Buddhas. Here the offering consists of enough jewels to equal all the Mount Sumeros in the universes. And since every world in a billion world system has a Mount Sumero, a universe contains a billion Mount Sumeros. Latent in the use of such an image is the mountain of the self. Just as Sumero is the greatest object in any world, the self is the greatest conception of any mind. Hence, this offering turns all the selves of the universe into piles of jewels and lays them before the Tathagatas. This is why such an offering, contrary to what Tung Li says below, is the greatest offering of all. And yet, such an offering cannot compare to giving this teaching to those who are not Tathagatas. The text continues, and a noble son or daughter grasped but a single four-line gatha of this Dharma teaching of the perfection of wisdom and made it known to others, Subhuti, their body of merit would be greater by more than a hundredfold, indeed, by an amount beyond comparison. Sing Chao says, a pile of jewels has its limits. A profound understanding is never exhausted. Subhuti, what do you think? Does it occur to the Tathagata, I rescue beings? Surely, Subhuti, you should hold no such view. And why not, Subhuti? The being does not exist who is rescued by the Tathagata. Subhuti, if any being were rescued by the Tathagata would be attached to a self. He would be attached to a being, attached to a life, and attached to a soul. Attachment to a self, Subhuti, is said by the Tathagata to be no attachment. Yet foolish people remain attached, and foolish people, Subhuti, are said by the Tathagata to be no people. Thus are they called foolish people. There's that device again. You give an adjective to a thing, though the thing was never created, does not exist in and of itself. So, what does your adjective do? In chapter 3, the Buddha tells us that the Bodhisattva sets forth on a path to enlightenment by resolving to liberate all beings, but does so while remaining attached to perceptions of a self, a being, a life, or soul. Here the Buddha says that after having achieved the goal of enlightenment, a Bodhisattva does not now become exempt from this dictum. Just as a bodhisattva liberates no beings, neither does a Buddha rescue beings, for to do so would amount to belief in an entity and thus an attachment. But because neither the subject who is attached nor the object of attachment is real, every attachment is essentially no attachment. It's just part of that play in the mind. And yet people are attached. Thus, such people are called foolish, because they do not see that their attachments are empty of any self-nature, and therefore no attachments. Still, even though they are foolish and clinging to what isn't real, they are but a thought away from Buddhahood. Thus, Buddhas rescue no one. Foolish people rescue foolish people. Chao Ming titles this, Instructing Without Instructing. Hui Neng says, although no school of instruction exists without an expedient tools, essentially there is nothing to hold on to. Thus follows a chapter on instructing without instructing. De Ching says, Subhuti had previously heard that Buddhas and beings are not different. But if they are not different, then they are no beings. Why then say the Tathagata saves beings, since this would involve the concept of self and other? In what follows, self and other both disappear. Subhuti, what do you think? Does it occur to the Tathagata I rescue beings? Surely, Subhuti, you should hold no such view, and why not? The being does not exist who is rescued by the Tathagata. Again, this is a repetition of the... In Chapter 3, the Buddha tells Subhuti that those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path resolve to parinirvapya, liberate all beings, and to lead them to nirvandadhatu, realm of nirvana, but do so without being attached to such perception as self or being, which they are able to transcend or transform through the cultivation of wisdom. What's wisdom? Where does wisdom occur? In the mind. So this is constantly about the mind. How we perceive, why we perceive, why it's really perceiving nothing. The emphasis is not on liberation in the realm of nirvana, but on rescue from the realm of samsara, birth and death. Another crucial difference is that previously the emphasis was on the point of view of a bodhisattva. Here the point of view is that of a Buddha. Vasubandhu says, again, the doubt arises. If dharmas are undifferentiated and neither superior nor inferior, why does the Tathagata talk about saving beings? Asanga says, undifferentiated is the dharma realm, but where Buddhas save no beings, for neither name nor body exists outside the dharma realm. Vasubandhu comments, if it were said that there was a soul within the body to be liberated, this would amount to asserting the existence of a being. Thus, the sutra says attachment to a self is no attachment. Sheng Chao says, enlightenment is the fruit that isn't picked. Teaching is the doctrine that forgets the words. Bunch of poets. Attachment to a self, Subhuti, is said by the Tathagata to be no attachment. Yet foolish people remain attached, and foolish people, Subhuti, are said by the Tathagata to be no people. Thus, they are called foolish people. All attachments are manifestations of attachment to a self. That's what I said earlier. It all begins there. The self is the only reality of which we are aware since birth. All other realities are simply reflections and transmissions of this one underlying reality. At least we assume this reality to be real. Yet when we examine ourself in the light of wisdom, it is found to be without any basis at all. This is the only obstruction standing between foolish people and Buddhas. If foolish people realize that they are not people, much less foolish, they would be Buddhas. As long as they don't, they remain foolish people. Asanga says, attachment to a self is the same mistake as attachment to a dharma. Attachment to saving beings is attachment to what allows no attachment. St. Chao says, foolish people aren't real. They can thus be transformed into sages. Li Huanhui says, who has a self is a foolish person. Who has no self is the master of wherever they are and acts without limits. Thus it is said, foolish people are the cause of Buddhas, and Buddhas are the result of foolish people. Interesting. All right. We're ripping along here. And I'm afraid to say, at 50 minutes, I think we're going to have a part 6. But we ripped through there pretty good. So we're coming to a culmination of the sutra, but I think it's important to finish it because concepts are hitting us fast and furious now as he comes to a close. So With that, I'm going to continue to record, but it'll have to be another session, as we've already found out. My movie software here can only handle an hour. So before it cuts me off mid-sentence once again, I will bid you a temporary respite. You can replay this video or study in any way you like. I will post this and the following one by tonight. So thank you again. I would have no reason for doing this if it weren't for you. So thank you. Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. Until I see you again.